Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, September the 4th, day number 247 of 2014. That was the music of my good friend Carlos Guedes, who, by the way, on Friday nights, Carlos is playing at a great Brazilian restaurant here in the Dallas area. I'm going to put the details in Facebook. If you live in the Dallas area and you have nothing to do Friday night, it would be a fabulous place to go enjoy some good Brazilian beef, very good beef, as you know, in Brazil. And enjoy the music of Carlos. He, of course, plays the harp. He's got a little band. He's got a little CD. And I hope you get to watch him. He's a really good guy. And I guess enjoy a little meal, maybe a little dancing on Friday night with my friend Carlos Guedes. Tonight we're going to touch base with Barry Jacobson, our military historian. We're going to be looking at Chapter 5 of World War I. It started 100 years ago. And we've been looking at different parts, different chapters of the World War I story. Tonight we're going to be getting to the end a little bit. We're entering year 1918, and we're going to start not so much wrapping it up because it still took a little bit of more time, but we're going to look at some aspects of this war, in particular the weapons that were introduced in World War I. I mean, that was probably the most dynamic thing about World War I were some of the brand-new weapons that were introduced, like the airplane, for example, poison gas, the submarine, lots of things, the machine gun, tanks. All of these weapons were introduced in World War I. Obviously, they had a change in warfare, a very important change in warfare. So we're going to get into all of that with Barry tonight as we look at Chapter 5 of World War I. Just a quick note, Audible.com, your source for audiobooks. If you're the kind of person that likes to listen to books, you know, a lot of people like to read books, obviously, like myself, but a lot of people like to listen to audiobooks because they're busy. You know, you're a salesperson, you're driving around for your business or whatever, and you don't really have time to sit down. Well, audiobooks are the next best thing. Audible.com, we have a link on the show information. Click on that. It'll take you to audible.com, and you're going to check out this amazing inventory that this company has. I mean, they've got books on just about every topic. I'm assuming they must have some books on World War I as well. So audible.com, check them out. Go to the show information. Click on audible.com. Get yourself a book, and if you do, you're going to make my day. Say it again. If you get yourself a book, you're going to make my day. We're going to take a break, and we've got Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let me say hello to Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am as well as can be expected for a man of my advanced years.
Oh, come on, come on. You're just a young man.
Well, I'm 58. I actually will be 59 at the end of this year. I drink a morning glass of formaldehyde and orange juice, which keeps me well-preserved, but...
Your mind is that of a 25-year-old, as we're going to find out tonight.
Well, I hope so. You know, I think I lose brain cells every Friday night when I go out drinking. We'll see how much I lost last week.
Well, that's why we do the show on Thursday nights.
Well, there you go. You're still, you know, from Thursday to Thursday, there's that intervening weekend, and it always remains to be seen how I'll be Monday morning. Will I be fit for service?
But you lose it on weekends, and then you get it back on Monday, right?
Unfortunately not. You know, of all the cells of your body, apparently, neuro cells don't regenerate. At least brain cells don't.
All right. Well, now we learned something new tonight. Not only are you a military historian, but you know something about the human body. That's a good thing.
Particularly the female body. I spend many, many decades studying that.
Well,
of course, the people. Of course, the female mind is...
Now you're joking me a little bit here, but I got to get a glass of water. You had me, you really had me going there, but let me. I have to drink water. You had me choking there, but go right ahead. Talk about the female body. That's okay.
Well, I actually was going to mention the female mind. You know, the female body is a study all of its own, but the female mind is a mystery that no man can really fathom. And believe me, I've tried.
Yes, but as they say, women are special. I'll just put it that way.
Well, they are. They're, you know, that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, that's very true. The reason Venus is uninhabitable today is because women once lived there.
Okay, well, I'll just repeat what I said. Women are special, and then you can fill in the blank. the special adjective, you know, I'll just say women are special, and then you can fill in the blank, you know. That way you can fill in whatever suits the moment, you know. They're special. Blank, and then you fill in that word depending on how you feel about women at a particular time. But tonight we're going to be looking at our Chapter 5 of World War One, Barry. But before we get there, you know, big news today with the passing of Joan Rivers, a very funny lady, to say the least. She was 81 years old. From what I understand, it happened fairly quickly. And I thought she was a hilarious woman. I mean, she was... really a rare thing. There aren't really that many, well, I shouldn't say this, there are many women who are very funny, but there aren't that many comics like her, and I just thought she was very unique and very funny, and it's sad to see her go. I mean, she was a very funny lady, even at 81, Barry.
Well, if you go to modern comedy circuits or listen to a comedy radio station, like on Sirius Satellite Radio, they have, I think, three or four comedy stations. You'll see there's probably one out of every four comics are probably female. That's just a rough number, but one out of four. But Joan Rivers hit the scene in the late 50s, and she really blazed the trail. Before her, female comics like Phyllis Diller were more physical comics. They're physical comedy. Their shtick was basically the way they looked. You think of Minnie Pearl and Phyllis Diller. Minnie Pearl had the funny hats, and Phyllis Diller had the funny hair. But Joan Rivers was a real, honest-to-God, stand-up comic that relied on her jokes and her
right.
wit. And she, really
she was quick
the
also. She was quick.
Oh, very, very. Well, you
she
know,
was very
she
quick
was,
on her feet, yeah.
She was one of her more recent jokes made just this year, I think, or maybe last year, was Justin Bieber looks like the little girl that Cher wishes she had.
That is good. That is good. She had one today that I heard that the reason women cook for their husbands is so that their husbands can tell other women about their wives' food. I mean, I thought that was pretty good. I'm not doing
yeah.
it justice or something like that, she said. I thought it was pretty funny. But anyway, a very tragic loss, really, for the industry, because this is just a funny lady, a very funny lady, and our sympathies, obviously, to her family and lots of fans who are going to miss her a lot, like the two of us. But, Barry, before we get to the On This Day in History, and you have a battle that you want to talk to us about that has to do with World War One, I just want to take a minute here and talk about this day in our family history, because it was on this day in 1964. In fact, about this time of the day, it was, let's say, about 8:30, 9 o'clock, that the plane landed in Miami. We had a very interesting trajectory that summer. We started in Cuba. We had to go to Mexico City because there were only two ways of leaving Cuba back then. You either left through Mexico or through Spain, and we wanted to come to the United States. So we went to Mexico for about a week, actually even landing in Mexico became a bit of a drama because there were lots of mechanical problems with our plane landing that day. And I think it was on that day that I realized that God must have had a plan for me because he kept me alive that day. I mean, that plane ride was a little bit scary landing in Mexico City. But anyway, then we went to Jamaica for a couple of months, and that's where we waited for our papers to come into the United States, and then we finally made it into the United States on this day, about this time of the day, about 9 o'clock or so in the evening. And I've always, it's one of those days that you always think about, and obviously when you get up to 50 years, a 50-year anniversary becomes even more meaningful. I spoke with my parents earlier today, just kind of joking around the idea that it was 50 years ago. They have a great memory of this day, by the way, which is super. They have a great memory of this day. But I tell you, it is really amazing. I think to have come to the United States and to have grown up here and to have enjoyed the freedoms and what this great country offers is something that I can never appreciate enough. But I also want to say tonight that I've always had a great deal of respect for my parents because of their sacrifice and what they did for us. And on days like this, Barry, I really think about them and their great sacrifice and what they lost and how they had to start all over again, and they did it successfully because they're good people and because of hard work, Barry. So I just wanted to put that in as a thought to my parents and my brother and my sister on this 50th anniversary of our arrival to the United States, Barry.
Well, and I thank them because I certainly wouldn't be on this show if you hadn't come. And
no,
I think your show is
Cuba. We wouldn't be doing the show from Cuba, I'll tell you that right now.
Probably not more than a couple times before they caught up to you.
Before I ended up in jail if we did this.
That's right. Well, you know, I lived in Florida, South Florida, Palm Beach for a while, and I did business in Miami. And I got to know several Cubans personally as friends, and got to know the Cuban community just kind of peripherally. Discovered I kind of like Cuban food. It's very unique. But the thing I really like that stuck out more than anything else was this stuff they had called Cuban coffee.
Oh.
And if, you,
yes.
if you're out there, it's in Texas, but in Florida they have it over South Florida.
Right, right.
And for those who don't know what it is, imagine if you took five espressos and condensed them into a thimble-sized cup of coffee.
Right.
That's what a Cuban coffee is.
That's right. And I remember as a kid, my father, you know, we would have dinner, and my father would walk down about two blocks. There was a place that made Cuban coffee. I guess my mom didn't make it. It was not that – people didn't make it at home that much. They usually went out to get it. So I would walk with my father like two blocks to this little corner place. And my father would get that little cup of coffee that you're talking about, and then he would get a cigar. So here I was walking home with my dad after he had enjoyed that little Cuban coffee that you're talking about and a nice cigar, and I always kept thinking to myself, I must have been 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever, I kept saying to myself, you know, someday I'm going to do that. Someday I'm going to walk to that store, and I'm going to get me a little Cuban cigar and a coffee. And that, obviously, it didn't happen. But that, to me, I just remember how happy my father looked when he was drinking that coffee and smoking that cigar. He looked very, very happy. And it's one of those things that stands out in your mind, you know, a great memory and something you don't forget there. Some things you don't forget. You know, this is amazing. A lot of people have asked me, how do you have such a good memory for stuff that's in your book? Well, not all of it. A lot of it, obviously, I checked with my parents, but there's some things you don't forget when you go through what we went through. And I was saying today that if I had, you know how people can get into a time tunnel and travel back to a particular time? If I had the opportunity to get into a time tunnel and just, I just had 10 minutes to go back and said, okay, you can go back for 10 minutes anytime you want to, I would go back to that summer right before we took that plane to the United States. It was an amazing moment in our lives, and that flight to the United States was very interesting, Barry, if I could just take a quick second, because the plane was going from Jamaica to Miami, from Kingston to Miami. It obviously flew over Cuba. And I remember we were flying over Cuba, and my mother looked out the window of the plane, and you could see all these little lights, you know. And the look in her face was, you know, kind of melancholy and sad, you know, because she was looking down and she knew that somewhere down there was her past, you know. And the look in her face, a look of sadness to some degree, and it was just one of those things that you will never forget as we took that flight, Barry. So anyway, I salute my parents on our 50th anniversary of arriving here in the United States. Now let's get into World War I because we got some great topics tonight. And there's an important battle on this day in history, Barry. Why don't you take it away?
Well, there's two that are very close. One is, of course, the British, American, and French intervention that started right around this time in Russia in 1918. American forces landed at the Russian northern port of Archangel. Archangel is even further north than St. Petersburg. It's on the White Sea, which is about as far north as you can get without being frozen in all year round. And it was an attempt by the Allies. We also landed, by the way, at Vladivostok on the Pacific coast of Russia. And the goal was twofold. We landed in Archangel as well as Vladivostok to begin a campaign to try to strangle Bolshevism, also known as communism, in its cradle, in its beginning, in its inception. If you remember from our previous show, the Russian Revolution had just broken out the year before, and the communists had taken over, the Bolsheviks had taken over Russia, and they had promptly made peace with Germany and dropped out of the war. And the Allies wanted to get them back into the war by putting the White Russians, the opposition to the communists, back in power. And that's what this effort was. It was also an effort in the Pacific side, in Vladivostok. It was sort of a rescue mission. And this is a really strange and little-known tale, but apparently in 1917, there was about 100,000 Czech from Czechoslovakia. Of course, back then it was called Bohemia, but a bunch of Czech soldiers that used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian army that had been taken prisoner by the Russians. And with Russia falling out of the war, they were supposed to be repatriated via Vladivostok and the Pacific coast back to their home country. But the communists, the Soviets, were holding them against their their will and against the law, and probably would have killed them because that's just the way the communists operate. So the Czechs overpowered their guards. There was, as I said, quite a few of them, 100,000. And they took the weapons from local Soviet units they destroyed or routed. And these veteran Czech soldiers began this long march, this trek across Siberia, temporarily fighting with White Russians along the way, or I should say on the side of the White Russians along the way against the communists. And eventually making their way to Vladivostok, where they escaped. And we were there to help them get out. So it was American Rescue Mission back in 1918, 1919. So that is one of those days in history that began this day. And then the other thing is we shouldn't forget is on the 1st of September, just passed, was the anniversary of the beginning of World War II. It's the day that Hitler invaded Poland.
Right.
And if you remember your history, he forged or trumped up some sort of cause of war, what was called a black flag operation, and with an excuse, he attacked Poland in the early hours of the morning with a massive artillery barrage and then a blitzkrieg, and that's what was actually the beginning of what is called blitzkrieg,
right,
the lightning war that the Germans practiced. And that began on September 1st.
That's right, and he did it with overwhelming force. I think that's what you're saying, right? He really went in, and it was like, you know, almost like in a football sense, it would be like, when they have the blitz, I guess, you know, when all the entire defense goes after the quarterback, you know, that kind of thing, you know. That's kind of the football version of what he did. Wouldn't you say that?
Well, yeah, the reason the blitz is called a blitz in football is because much like blitzkrieg in warfare, it's a rapid rush through the line, through the enemy line, bypassing strong points, or in the case of football, you know, big linemen, shooting the gaps and running right for the quarterback and trying to overwhelm the quarterback, who is the commander of the enemy side, the enemy football
right.
team. And in Blitzkrieg, it's the same thing. You're using armored forces, heavily supported by aircraft and artillery, and break through the weak points in the enemy line. And instead of trying to destroy those each in detail, just bypassing them and heading deep into the enemy territory, where you attack their communications and command centers. And this rapidly overthrew Poland, and was soon, the following year, rapidly overwhelmed France as well.
And not to get off on World War II, because we'll do shows on that at some point, but I think it was not only a blitz in a military sense, but it was also a blitz, I think, in a diplomatic sense, because he really caught a lot of the Europeans by surprise. I think a lot of Europeans didn't think he would do this, a lot of the European leaders, that is. And a couple of days after the September 1st, I think Britain and other countries declared war on Germany. So that was kind of the, as you say, the beginning of World War II. I guess we'll be doing the, which anniversary? I mean, that would be, of course, we won't be around to do the 100th anniversary, Barry, but maybe we can do a 70th anniversary pretty soon of, next year will be the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Interesting, you're talking about anniversaries. Another important anniversary this week was the end of World War II, the surrender, the Japanese surrender. So we have a few shows to do next year, Barry.
And I'm looking forward to it. It's this one's been fun.
That's right. Well, let's get into this World War One show. We've got a couple of segments. You broke it up for us tonight to a couple of segments, and the first one is some of the personalities, some of the heroes, some of the names of World War One, and then of course. The other part is going to be the weapons, as I said in the introduction. What made this war so unique and so amazing is the weapons, that for the first time soldiers were being shot at by machine guns or poison gas, obviously airplanes, and that had never happened before at this scale, obviously. So where do you want to go first, the heroes or the weapons?
Let's do the heroes, and the last hero we'll get to will be the one that will lead us right into weapons.
Great. Well, let's take it away.
Baron.
All
so,
right.
Yeah, you know, warfare always produces both heroes and villains, and, of course, depending on which side you're on is kind of how you view each one.
Heroes and villains, Barry, that's a song by the Beach Boys.
Is it really? I should know
right.
That. I'm a big
fan. I know music. Anyways, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I had to get that in.
You got it in before I was on a roll, so it's okay.
Yeah, I'm really on a roll tonight. That must be that cigar I smoked. No, I didn't smoke a cigar.
You know, so for a war that was known for how drab, and we think of it as a colorless war, mostly because the footage that came out of it was all in black and white. You know, the newsreel footage is very drab. And that's in color is pretty muddy. The whole war was fought, at least in the West, and we think of it as a war of mud. Men digging into the trenches and you know, the rains and the muck of Flanders Field. But despite that, despite being so colorless, it produced some colorful characters. And I'm going to basically go through one for each of the Allied and German armies. Germans actually did two because they were, I didn't justify that because they had twice as much fighting as they fought on both fronts. But let's start with the American hero. In America, we produced heroes all throughout our wars, but up until World War One, America's heroes were mostly our generals. You know, if you think of anything from the American Revolution through the Spanish-American War, it's very hard to find the public really aware of a single individual soldier as a hero. Now, certainly there were some. But you have to dig pretty deep in the weeds to find their name. We all know who Washington was. We know who Grant was. We know who Lee was. We know who Teddy Roosevelt was at San Juan Hill during the Spanish-American War. But the first real pop hero, if you will, in American history that was produced by war was produced in World War One. A guy whose name became a household name, and his name was Sergeant York, Alvin C. York. And he was an interesting character. He was a very religious man from the hills of Tennessee. You'd probably describe him as a hillbilly. And he had, early in his life, he'd been almost an outlaw. He'd been something of a bandit, a real ruffian. He was a bootlegger before there was bootlegging. You know, before he was outlawed, he was making whiskey up the hills. And he was robbing and bullying people, and he was quite the character. He was also an expert shot. He win money, prize money, in what was called turkey shoots. He was the best shot probably in the state, maybe one of the best shots in the country, if not the world. And if you think of Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, this region of the country was famous for its marksmen. And all those characters, including York, Alvin York, made money off turkey shoots. And this is where you actually went out and shot wild turkeys, and you made money, prize money, from doing it, as well as getting the turkey, you know, for food. And York was very good at this. Well, at some point in his life, prior to the war, York became very religious. He had a religious conversion. The story is he was actually hit by lightning, or very nearly hit by lightning, while riding in a rainstorm. And like Saul on the Damascus Road, he got religion in a big way after that. So when World War I came along, York was a conscientious objector, meaning he didn't want to fight. He had a deep aversion to violence, surprising a man so violent in his past. But, you know, that was an age when America was a religious country, just in general, unlike today. And the military was probably more religious than any other single institution. And his commander, he was originally drafted into or attached to the 82nd Airborne, or actually 82nd Infantry. It became the 82nd Airborne during World War II, but it was 82nd All-American Division. And he was about to be shipped overseas, and he went to his commanding officer and said, you know, I can't fight. It's against my religion. I've struggled with this, but I can't. I don't think I can kill somebody without breaking God's commandments. And his commander pointed out several passages in the Bible which supported a just war. And these arguments go back all the way to St. Augustine, or St. Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas. And then he sent him home on leave to talk to his personal preacher back in Tennessee. And when York came back, he was convinced that it was okay, that there was a time for war. And in fact, he became probably as evangelical a warrior as we've ever produced. He suddenly saw World War I as sort of a crusade that was his duty now to do. And he gets over there, and in the great battles of the Argonne Forest in 1918, we'll get to that next week when we talk about the final battles that ended the war. But at the Argonne Forest, in one of those fights, the 82nd, one of the regiments, which York was attached to, got pinned down by a German machine gun. On a ridge overlooking their position as they were advancing. And they were advancing to try to cut a railroad line, and they had to pass this hill. And unfortunately, the hill was defended by a battalion of German soldiers and a machine gun nest as well. And York described it as they were cutting men down like wheat, like a lawnmower cuts down tall grass. Men were just falling all around him. And nobody could move. The whole offensive just came to a stop. So York, a group of 18 men under the command of a sergeant, who was a corporal at this point, were tasked with moving forward around the flank and trying to flank this position. And they managed to get halfway there when they ran to a German unit about to attack, and they captured this unit of a few dozen men. And that brought them, unfortunately, to the attention of the machine gun, which then turned its guns on them and killed a third of them right away, just cut them down, including the sergeant who was in command, a fellow named Early, Sergeant Early. And York was the senior corporal at this point. And because he had all these prisoners, he didn't know quite what to do with, and they really couldn't move. They were pinned down. He told all the rest of the survivors, of which there were about a dozen left, to stay put and guard the prisoners, and he would try to take out the machine gun nest. And crawling forward to a position where he could get a sight picture on the trench, German trench line, he fixed his rifle sights. And these were the bolt-action Enfield rifles. They had a range of about 1,000 yards. These were very effective weapons. And he began making turkey noises like he'd make to flush a turkey out of the woods during a turkey shoot. And every time a German would pop his head up to see where's that turkey, they could hear it, he'd shoot him. And he shot dozens of Germans this way.
That's pretty clever.
Until the machine gun, and until the commander decided to send a party of six men with bayonets to rush him and kill him. He ran out of bullets at this point, so he was really in a tough position. But he pulled his service 45 caliber pistol, and back in his old gunfighter bandit days, he was a pretty crack shot with a pistol as well. And he shot them all dead. And then the German commander, in despair, and this is the battalion commander, offered to surrender and accepted. He ended up single-handedly capturing about 175 German soldiers.
Wow.
Which he marched them promptly back to Allied lines, and the offensive to continue with machine guns having been knocked out. For that, he was given the Medal of Honor, and he was given the French Cross of War and the French, it's Croix de Guerre in French. He was given a variety of medals from every country in Europe, from Italy to Montenegro. And a ticker tape parade went down back to the United States. And he became, he became our first top war hero in American history.
Now, where does the name Sergeant York come from, either from a television show or
was he marketed in a movie?
Okay.
Well, yeah, he was made famous. Of course, he was famous in his day, but he's made particularly famous by a film in which Gary Cooper called Sergeant York. Gary Cooper played him in the film.
There you go.
And it was made in the 1930s and was one of the great bio war movies probably ever made.
I see. That's what I remember, the movie, yeah. Also a radio show, I believe, as well. I could be wrong on that, but
you could be right.
Yeah, I just don't remember. But the movie, you're right. Yeah, I do remember the movie. Yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, there was a Sergeant York tank and a Sergeant York artillery piece that was made much later.
Yes, yes. So that's our first hero, Sergeant York. Who are some of the others?
That was America's great hero. And then, of course, the British had their heroes. And that's not to say there weren't more heroes on both sides and all sides, but I'm just going to center on a couple of the top ones. And probably the most famous hero of World War I from a British standpoint, that was not a general, of course, I'm centering on non-commanders, focusing on non-commanders, was a guy they also made a movie about. In fact, it might be perhaps one of the great movies of all time. It's called Lawrence of Arabia, and it's about a fellow by the name of Thomas Edward Lawrence, or T.E. Lawrence. And we've talked about him in previous episodes a couple weeks back. But he's a fascinating character. Lawrence was a Englishman, of course, or actually probably a Welshman. And he had a good academic background in archaeology. And between 1908 and 1914, when the war broke out, he had been on several university expeditions, archaeological expeditions, one as late as 1914 before the war. That one for the British government, in which he traveled all throughout the Ottoman Empire in the Near East. And if we remember, the Ottoman Empire controlled almost the entire Middle East at this point. The British had forces in Egypt, had been there for a century, but other than that, the entire Middle East was basically part of the Turkish Empire, which was Axis during the war, or I should say Central Powers. They weren't called the Axis to World War II, but the Axis were the Central Powers, Germany, Turkey, and Austro-Hungary. But Lawrence had been an archaeologist. He knew the area well. He traveled the trains, rode the Ottoman trains during his archaeological expeditions. And in particular, in 1914, for the British government, he had scouted the Sinai Peninsula and southern Palestine, the desert south of there, supposedly looking for some biblical ruins. But really, he was part of an expedition to scout out the future site of the war, where the British knew they would be fighting the Turks. The British coming out of Egypt, the Turks coming out of Palestine. So in 1917, Lawrence is now an officer, a young officer in the British Army. He's in his late 20s or mid to late 20s. And he's given the job by General Allenby, the new commander in Egypt, to go as an ambassador, because he spoke Arabic, and Turkish as well. And he was going to go to down towards Mecca, where there was a tribe there, a tribe of Bedouin and Arabs, led by a man named Prince Faisal, and try to make common cause with them against the Turks, and to foment the Arab uprising against the Turks. Now, there was no Saudi Arabia back in those days. Arabia was a bunch of different Bedouin tribes. The House of Saud was just beginning about that point to gain power in the central part of the Arabian Peninsula. But the area around Mecca was controlled by Prince Faisal. And that was important to the Turks because Mecca is the Arab holy place, the Muslim holy place. And it had been controlled by the Turks since the 16th century, the heyday of the Ottoman Empire. And there was only one railroad line that went all the way from Damascus south through Jordan and down to Arabia along near the coast and eventually arrives at Mecca. And that's the way the Turks would supply their garrisons. And Lawrence made contact with Faisal and was given permission to recruit and lead an Arab Bedouin army in raids against the Turkish rail line, particularly, and other Turkish positions. He captured Aqaba with the Arab army coming from the land side. Aqaba is a fortified port that guards the waterway into the Sinai Peninsula on the western side. I'm sorry, the eastern side. And eventually, he and his Arab army went all the way to Damascus. They basically flanked Allenby's advance into Palestine, which we'll talk about next week. And when the British ended up pushing the Turks out of the Middle East, it was with the help of Prince Faisal's army, commanded by this fellow Lawrence of Arabia. And he became very famous because he had a correspondent that traveled with him all throughout his various adventures. Lowell Thomas was the name. Took lots of pictures and, sent them back to the newspapers in America and in Britain. He became quite the hero. He even looked a little bit like Peter O'Toole, who played him in the movie. He wore these flowing white Arab robes.
Yeah, and that was the point I wanted to make, Barry, that you are talking about the Lawrence Arabia in the movie. That was a real character, a real person.
That was a real person. He died eventually, I think he died in 1929 or 28 in a motorcycle accident back in Britain.
Oh, really?
Actually, it was later than that. I'm looking it up now. It's 1935, actually. Mm-hmm. But he died in a motorcycle accident. But at the end of World War One, he was one of the most famous Britons in the world.
Right.
He became quite a celebrity. And as we'll talk about next week, when we talk about the post-war changing of the maps, how Britain and France basically rewrote the map, Lawrence had a big part of that, big hand in that, in creating the modern Middle East.
Right. Yeah, and that's something just to refresh everybody, everyone's memory. We're going to be doing another show. We may actually end up doing two more shows. I don't know. We'll do whatever we need, but definitely we're going to be doing one more show on how World War One changed the map of the world, and it's so connected to what is happening out, Barry. It is interesting how what we're seeing now is so much a connection back to World War One. I'm talking about the boundaries of many of these countries. So I interrupted you. So go ahead and let's return to the heroes, and then let's get to the weapons.
Well, let me just touch on what you just said, just real briefly, and not take the wind out of my sails next week. But that's a great point. We see ISIS basically remaking the map of the Middle East, ignoring the Syrian border, basically annexing Syria to parts of Iraq. And they feel justified, in a sense they are, because to the people of the Middle East, those boundaries are fairly artificial. They were constructs of the European powers at the end of World War One. There really is no true nation of Transjordan, or later became Jordan, or Lebanon, or Syria, or Iraq. Those are all constructs of the Allied powers. And in fact, Prince Faisal, we just mentioned, who was Lawrence of Arabia's patron, became the first king of Iraq, of all places.
Right.
So after he got ousted out of Saudi Arabia by the House of Saud. So, but we'll get to that you know, when do we get
to that?
Yeah,
we'll get to that next week. But the point I was trying to make, and I'm glad you also made it, Barry, is that the map of the world really changed after World War One, and we're dealing with some of those boundaries right now.
That's very right. Now, moving on, the next hero is German. You know, we've done an American hero. We've done a British hero. Now, the Germans are going to get two heroes because they fought on two fronts. We're going to talk about one on the Western Front in a minute, but right now we're going to talk about one that fought on the Eastern Front and then later the Italian Front. And this is a fellow which his name is very well known to any student of World War II. He, you know, arguably was the most celebrated and best known German general of the entire war, the entire Second World War. He was called the Desert Fox, and his name is Erwin Rommel. Now, you wonder why we're talking about Rommel, a World War II general, now. It's because he first came to light as a hero of World War One.
Right.
The War of Tanks, he became famous as a tank leader, as a panzer leader with the Africa Corps. But long before there were tanks were just beginning, as we'll talk about in a minute, to come into existence. But long before that, Rommel was a soldier, and he was a ski soldier. He was a ski trooper, commander of an Alpine battalion. Back in those days, you know, say we had the 10th Mountain Division. Well, that idea of having mountain divisions is a fairly old concept, and there were several of these during World War One. And the Germans had, of course, theirs that fought in the Italian frontier, where the Italian Alps were in dispute between the Austrians, the Germans on one side, and the Italians on the other. And Rommel commanded these ski troops, and in several engagements, often with very small forces, a couple hundred men at best, and one he had a dozen men, one of his engagements, he captured 1,500 men, 1,500 Italian soldiers, by skiing behind their position and capturing the high ground. And then he only had with him 43 officers and men. So with basically less than 50 men, he captured 1,500 Italians. And for that, he was awarded the Iron Cross, second class. That was in 1915. And he duplicated and actually bettered that record a few years later during the Corporetto Battle. He turned the position of with only 100 men and captured 7,000 Italian troops with 100 men. Now, he's not a personal, hero in the sense of, Alvin York, where he went out with his rifle and captured 100 men, shooting down many in the process. But Rommel, with very few men, never more than a couple hundred, and usually less, achieved amazing successes. And he was awarded for this, first the Iron Cross, first class. That's kind of their version of our Distinguished Service Cross, the German version. And then later he was awarded their version of the Medal of Honor, which is called the Blue Max or the Croix de Mérite, and it means the cross for merit. And Rommel became quite the hero of World War One, and then later on when between the First and Second World War, during the so-called Weimar Republic, he was one of the few officers to be selected to be part of the new tiny, minuscule, 100,000-strong German army that was the Reichswehr. That was all that Germany was allowed under the Treaty of Versailles to have. And because it was so tiny, only the very best were allowed to serve in it. Rommel was selected as one of those very best. And then, of course, he went on to become Hitler's favorite general and become the famous general of World War II a little bit later.
Right. And
so that's Erwin Rommel.
One quick point I wanted to make, Barry. These wars were only separated. I mean, World War One ended in 1918. World War Two began in 1939, ended in 1945. So that's only a span of 20 or 25 years. Obviously, in the professional life of an officer, I mean, you could be 30 years old and then be 55 in the Second War. So it's not that unusual.
That's right.
That there would be men who would be in both. In both wars, most notably President Truman, who was a sergeant in the first one, then, of course, President of the United States when the war ended. But you have one more, and there's a song about this next guy, too.
And I wish we had a way of bringing that song up right now, you know, like some radio shows do.
Well, we're gonna try to do that next week. I wish I had thought about that, but you're talking about Snoopy versus the Red Baron.
That's right. It was a song that came famous in the mid '60s when
by the Royal Guardsmen.
That's right.
That's right.
You saved me looking it up. I was gonna have to look that up.
There's two songs about the Baron. One is Snoopy versus the Red Baron, and then Snoopy's Christmas that mentions the Red Baron
as
well. So there you go. A little music lesson tonight, folks.
And of course, in those they come from these Charles Schulz cartoons that became very popular in the '60s and '70s as television specials. And one of those, Snoopy the dog, has this sort of daydream where he's on sitting on his doghouse. He's pretending it's an airplane, and he's fighting the Red Baron in World War One. He's got a little flight cap on, the leather, and little goggles for his eyes. And, of course, the Royal Guardsman made this song upon that imagery of Snoopy fighting the Red Baron. But the Red Baron really was a real character. And we're going to talk about planes in just a second because this segues beautifully into it, the advent of aircraft. But World War One was the first modern war. It was the first war in which we had lots of, you know, weapons we take for granted today that had never been seen before. And probably the most bizarre from the standpoint of those who lived in those days. The one that Napoleon would perhaps have predicted, but never dreamed of coming quite to that extent, was aircraft. In the 100 years between Napoleon and World War One, all scouting was done by cavalry. And, of course, it had been since ancient times. But by 1914, scouting of the battlefield was now being done by airplanes. I think the flight at Kitty Hawk by the Wright brothers was, 1905 or so, 1902,
right,
somewhere around then?
In that time, yeah.
And in that time frame. And there have been lots of advances in aircraft. But when the war begins, planes are just really pretty primitive. They don't have single-wing planes like we have today. They had, you know, biplanes and eventually triplanes because aircraft design didn't have a way of attaching wings strong enough and light enough to fly with a single wing. Aircraft aluminum hadn't been invented yet. So plywood and canvas was what these planes were made of. And the struts that held the wings together were made of metal, but you couldn't be too heavy or it wouldn't fly. So it was always a trade-off of weight versus power. And the bi-wing plane, the double-wing plane, was probably the best trade-off that came up with for the most part, for at least another 10 years after the war. So the character we're talking about, the Red Baron, as he's called, his real name is Manfred von Richthofen. And he is a baron. He's a German nobleman. And by all accounts, he's a man of very good character, very likable. And he actually wasn't even a very good pilot. He started as a cavalryman. Because he, again, scouts were mostly cavalrymen at the beginning of the war. And he was, you know, traditional branch for, just like George Patton, for men with that temperament, that knightly temperament, was horsemen. And he started there, but he very quickly moved into aircraft. But he wasn't very good. He wasn't a very good pilot. It took him a long time to get used to the controls, get comfortable in his plane. I think he even crashed a couple. So he spent the first 2 years of the war sort of in the background. But by 1917, he's moved to a hunter squadron, JASA, or Jagdstaffel, hunter squadron of fighters, and really begins to come into his own. Now, he's not the most skilled pilot, as we said. He's not known for his aerobatics, his fancy maneuvering. He's not a daredevil. He is coldly methodical, and he's very, very good with his machine gun, very good at lining up his plane and making every shot count. And in those days, if you shot down five planes, enemy planes, you were considered to be what was called an ace. An ace was someone who shot down five planes. I think the best Allied ace in the entire war shot down 40. I think I'd have to go back and look. Richthofen shot down 80-plus planes. I think the number was 82 or so, and by the time he was done, he had actually many more that weren't counted, because it couldn't be confirmed. You had to have a confirmed kill, meaning the enemy plane you downed had to either be observed by third party, or you had to find the rooms of that plane on the ground. And many of those planes crashed in positions where it couldn't be confirmed. So he may have had really quite a bit more. And he became really the terror of the Western Front, flying over the Western Front. Many men, as the song says, 80 men tried, 80 men died, is what the song says. And many men went up there deliberately looking for Rick Tobin, and none of them ever came back. He was quite the hero in Germany. He was the Red Knight in Germany. He was called the Red Devil to the Allies. But, you know, as we talked about it, men, we talked about airplanes. It was a different kind of war up in the air. You know, as grungy and barbaric and savage as the ground war tended to be, it was the linear opposite in the air. Their chivalry that had really gone out of fashion back in the Middle Ages was brought back. You know, pilots would salute each other as they flew past, and then they'd engage in some cases. When a pilot shot another pilot to the point where it was sure he was going to kill him, and of course, these are open-air aircraft. These aircraft have no cockpits, no canopies, I should say. They have cockpits, but no canopy. So they can actually look at each other. They can actually talk to each other in some cases, or at least yell at each other. And when you shot an enemy plane to the point where it was pretty helpless, you would actually flag him down, and he would accept, you know, and take surrender, and he would land on one of your airfields where he'd be interned for the war. Or he'd be returned with a prisoner exchange. We shot him fairly regularly. When he shot down enemy planes, he didn't kill him. If he didn't die on the crash, he'd fly by and fly over his crash site, and you might dip your wing to him, saluting him as you went by. You also might, when you get back to your own airfield, you might call and send a message to his airfield, let him know where he is so his own people could pick him up. So it was quite a different kind of war.
Right.
And Rick Tobin was really the preeminent figure of the air war during World War I.
Right. Here's what we're going to do, Barry. To do justice to the weapons segment, let's do that next week, because I know you want to get heavy into that because it's an important part of the war. But I thought maybe in a couple of minutes or 3 minutes we could sort of at least explain what the weapons were. I said obviously the airplane, the submarine, poison gas, the machine guns. This really changed the way war was fought, didn't it? I mean, when you're looking at a machine gun, that's the first time that soldiers had seen a machine, well, on both sides, I guess. They were shooting at each other with that veracity. I mean, that just didn't happen when it was one-on-one infantry or one-on-one confrontation as it had been for centuries.
Well, that's right. You have a lot of things appearing in World War I that became the standard and accepted, you know, means of war later. Starting with the machine gun, which you brought up, the machine gun first comes along in one form, its earliest form, perhaps. If we're not going to count Da Vinci coming up with ideas way back in the Renaissance, it first appears in the post, or actually appears during the American Civil War. You know, during the American Civil War, we invented a weapon called the Gatling gun, and this is a crank-operated multi-barrel machine gun. It actually doesn't switch from service during the war, even though it's invented in time for the American Civil War. But it becomes standard issue and is used during the Spanish-American War and in the Philippine insurrection. But during that war, between the Civil War and World War I, a guy by the name of Hiram Maxim invented what was called the Maxim gun. And that's the first true machine gun. It's got an electrical motor, and it's belt-fed and water-cooled, with a water jacket to keep it cool from the fire for a very long period of time without switching barrels. And it becomes a battle winner. A single machine gun can hold a section of the battlefield against thousands of men. One two-man crew can hold off thousands of men if they have a clear field of fire and a position that will protect them from artillery. Which is the only thing that can take them out, basically. And World War I became the death field, the death traps, the slaughter ground that became, mostly because of machine guns. Machine guns from fortified positions behind barbed wire, in bunkers, defended by trenches and defending trenches, in this vast swath of flat open areas in the Western Front. And that's what led to the bloodbaths that we see in World War I, where these machine guns just mow men down. So that's the first thing
Right. We'll
talk about. The second thing is of course, poison gas, which you've got to think of is the first weapon of mass destruction.
Yes.
When we talk about WMDs, the first one is poison gas, which comes into fruition and we first used in battle in 1915 on the Western Front by the Germans. And one of the reasons it was not used in World War II is because one of the victims of poison gas was Adolf Hitler, who was gassed. Being a frontline soldier in the trenches, he was gassed by mustard gas. In fact, his voice, which we hear in those famous newsreels and those famous speeches that have been taped, had a rasp in it because his voice was damaged, his throat was damaged by mustard gas. And that actually endeared him to the German populace because it was visible proof this guy had suffered for his country.
Right. And there's another personality. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead and finish that thought.
You were about to make a great point. I was going to say.
No, I was going to say that. That there was another personality, Hitler, who was actually involved in both wars.
That's right. Everybody who's involved in the Second World War in any big way began in World War I. All of them have a career, whether it's Churchill, whether it's Roosevelt, whether it's Hitler, and of course the little lesser figures, MacArthur, Patton, General Petain, who becomes the leader of Vichy France. He's the hero of World War One. Erwin Rommel, we've already mentioned. All these guys came out of World War One. All began there.
That's right. Go ahead.
I would say it really was the war that began the modern age in every sense of the word.
I think so. And we'll finish the next week with the weapons, and then next week we're going to talk about really wrapping up the war and hopefully get into some of the aftermath that was obviously very important, because some people said that, you know, the end of World War One was nothing, simply set up the beginning of World War Two. And it is interesting, within 20 or 25 years, we were back at it again, almost the same countries fighting each other again, Barry.
21 years later, Germany invades Poland. Yeah.
That's right. 21 years, isn't it? So that means that a baby born at the end of World War One was a soldier in World War Two.
That's right. And Erwin Rommel, for instance, we just talked about Rommel, he was born and was in the 1890s. He was 22 years old when he joined the army in World War One, and, of course, he's in his 40s, early 50s by the time he dies in World War Two.
That's right. That's right. No, it's just amazing. These two wars are so connected that it's just remarkable. But we'll continue next week, Barry, as always. We're going to continue next week. We will do then Chapter 6. Next week, as we look at the weapons and some of the aftermath, and if we've got to do a Chapter 7, we'll do that as well. But as always, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, I've loved this series, and I know the listeners have as well. And I know you have a blog. We have a link to your blog on the show information, and I hope your readers and your military history fans have also enjoyed the shows. I know a lot of people have complimented me on the shows and what a great job you're doing, Barry.
Well, thank you, and thank your listeners. Right now, I'm about to go, as soon as I get off the air, I'm about to complete a new piece I'm going to post on the Third Crusade, you know, Richard the Lionheart and Saladin. So I'm going to take a whole different direction on my blog.
Right.
So please go listen and go read that.
About 1,000 years apart, right, or something like that, those two events. But, Barry, thank you so much. That's right, you certainly do. You cover a lot of centuries.
We sure do. You know, I did a piece a couple days ago on World War One, and now I'm talking about the Crusades. You know, there's history is a huge canvas, and there's just so much to paint.
That's exactly right. Well, have a great evening, Barry, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
The pleasure again. It was all mine. Have a good evening.
All right. Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, our good friend, military historian. And we're just about out of time, folks, so I want to thank you so much for listening. And we're going to take you out tonight with the music of my good friend Carlos Guevez, who's playing here in town. And if you have a chance to go watch him, he's a fabulous musician, very creative, very original. And you're going to have a great time with Carlos. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas saying goodnight.